Hey, Property Insiders, I'm Mike Stanhouse, and this is the Inside Property Investing Podcast. Today, I am delighted to be joined by Rosie and Alan Charles of Arch Investments. Now, I'll be totally honest, I've spent like the last 2 years probably thinking of them as ARC Investments every time I see them on social media, thinking that it was some sort of abbreviation for architecture. But of course, after asking the question, I now know that it stands for Alan and Rosie Charles. And at least now you'll know and you'll remember to look for them next time you're on Instagram as well. But anyway, getting back to what this phenomenal couple have achieved in just a few short years. They started investing by breaking all of my rules, sourcing deals hours away from home and focusing on the humble single let instead of being distracted by shiny objects and newfangled strategies. It has clearly worked for them. Replacing Rosie's income and allowing her to step into property full time, whilst Alan kind of focuses on the strategy side of the business and also making sure that all of his toys are constantly being tossed from his pram. You will hear more in today's interview about how they've built a successful portfolio through consistent efforts and constantly putting themselves in challenging situations that they were then forced to find the solutions to, as well as the numbers behind their best and their worst deals, how they split the responsibility in their business, and why investing in education actually gave them the accountability they needed to persevere and succeed. I loved my chat with them, and I'm sure you will as well. But before we dive into it, let's just take a minute to thank our sponsors. So I recently came across a company called Hammock, and I immediately knew that they had a service I had to share with you. At its core, Hammock is a challenger bank that provides current account services designed specifically for landlords and property managers, but that really doesn't do it justice. Hammock combine property management with financial services to automate things like rent collection, simplify your bookkeeping, and ultimately save you time and money. They bridge the gap between your traditional bank account and your financial management system, whether that's a simple spreadsheet or more complex bookkeeping software, and the results are awesome. First of all, it tracks your income and your expenses either through your new Hammock current account or whichever bank you currently use. It'll then automatically monitor your rent status, alerting you to any missed payments across your portfolio so that you can quickly follow up with your tenants. And it also provides live analytics at a property and a portfolio level to show you insights like your profit and loss, your arrears, your occupancy rates, yields, and much more. It's a single app that can replace multiple different tools that you currently use in your business, many of which you're probably paying monthly fees for. This will reduce your monthly outgoings, but the value it provides goes way beyond that with the real-time overview of your portfolio finances. I love what I've seen so far from Hammock, and if you're on the hunt for a new current account for your property business, or if you'd prefer to make the most of open banking and connect your existing bank accounts to Hammock, then the best bet is to check it out yourself with a 30-day free trial at usehammock.com/insideproperty investing or via the show notes for this episode. Well, guys, I am delighted to have you here. I appreciate from both sides. We might have a few little interruptions from puppies in the background, but fingers crossed, it's all good. Before we dig into the puppy story, which I'm excited to hear, and obviously the property side of things, which I'm also equally excited to hear, I just wanted to say a massive thank you for being here and welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having us, Mike. As I've just mentioned, I've listened to virtually all of your podcasts, so I'm honoured to be invited on, so thank you so much.
Well, you're very welcome, and that's the beauty of the show, right? It's so nice to hear these stories of people who have kind of been on this journey with us. I know we've come along a massive way from when I first turned on the mic, God, 6 years ago now, I think it is, Rosie. Yeah. And you know, I guess for you guys as well, progress has been good over the last couple of years. So it kind of feels like we've all been going through this together, whether it's the podcast audience, you know, all the great people that we meet on social media, and particularly for both of us, Instagram has been a big influence in that. It feels like there is this really nice community in the property world that, you know, we've all kind of supported each other and cheered each other on over the past few years.
Yeah, definitely. We always get asked on Instagram how, you know, what tips we would give to people just starting out. And our default answer now is just listen to Inside Property Investing. You'll get far more information about that than you will out of us. So.
You're just sucking up now, but I appreciate it massively. Thank you guys for saying that. And we've kind of, in a bizarre way, started off with the last question of what your advice would be to other people, but we will come back to that shortly, I promise you. But I want to hear more about your own story first of all. And as you'll know if you've listened to the show, I like to go back to a time before property was in your life. So how far back in time do we need to go before property became an interest and a passion for both of you?
About 4 years.
Okay.
Yeah, about 4 years ago.
And what was life looking like then?
So we had, what were we, about 9 months after we bought our first home.
Yeah.
Living in Gravesend in Kent, which I've been told off for dissing far too much on previous public forums, so I won't go there too much. But we were living in Gravesend, and we had recently got engaged. So probably a couple of months after that, you know, we decided to go to a free seminar about property. We always wanted to save up to buy a buy-to-let house.
Okay.
After we bought our first home. And we kind of really just went to this seminar thinking, oh, maybe it will help us buy somewhere in the next 2 years instead of spending the next 3 or 4 years saving up the deposit. And it kind of snowballed, really, from there, didn't it?
Yeah, property has a habit of just sort of wriggling its way into our lives and then grabbing on and never letting go. And it's, it's a similar story I've heard multiple times. Was the purchase of your own house in any way an investment decision for you guys? Or was that literally just somewhere to live? We've got a job, you know, we need a house, so let's buy a home. Was it ever a... we'll buy it, we'll renovate it, we'll move on? Or was it literally, like I say, just a roof over your heads?
We were very keen for it to be an investment, but I was commuting to the other side of London at that time. So we were very limited with where we could buy. We had to be walking distance to the train station, and we looked at various different places and we weren't finding anything so that needed work. That was the idea. So we did just buy a nice done-up property, fairly done-up. It did need a bit of decorating, but that was it, really. So our idea of buying a doer-upper didn't come to fruition in the end.
Okay. And what were the... I mean, what sort of careers were you in? What industries were you working in back then?
So I had... I was working for TK Maxx on their grad scheme at their head office in Watford. So that was in merchandising and buying. That was my corporate life. I very quickly realised that the hour commute that I thought it was going to be was actually an hour and 45 on a
Oof.
Good day.
Yeah.
So after a couple of years of that, I decided to go back to a charity, and you were...
I work in new business for a defence engineering company, so I get to play around with loads of cool toys all day. I was doing that back then. I work for a different company now, bigger company, so I still do kind of a similar job, but I've worked in Kent most of that time, so I haven't been under, you know, commuting pressures like Rosie was. But there's a great story, actually, about why we chose Gravesend. Like Rosie said, so she could commute into Watford. 3 days before we completed on buying our first house in Gravesend, she handed in a resignation at TK Maxx. So we immediately had absolutely no reason to be living in Gravesend.
Yeah, and, I mean, these things happen, right?
Nicest place in Kent to live either.
Yeah, I kind of feel like 4 years later, there's still a little bit of tension on that subject, maybe.
We live in Canterbury now, so we have moved back to our home town, which we're much happier here.
Got you. Okay. And if, when you said that you kind of always wanted to buy a buy to let, what was the reason behind that? Was that with a view to you getting out of corporate life, Rosie, or was it longer term, just thinking, you know, property is a safe investment, maybe thinking about pensions in later life?
That's it. So my dad has a couple of student properties, and I've sort of seen him do that and how well they've done out of it. That's how they've grown their wealth. They both still work full time, but my mum and dad, but they've done really well with the properties they do have. So it was always in our head that we would like to buy a buy-to-let. We just didn't know how it could be done without saving loads of money.
Got you. Okay. And then that was about the time you went along to this property seminar, I guess.
Exactly.
Okay. And what did that, I mean, coming away from that, was it one of these like sort of 2-3 day weekend events where they throw a whole load of information at you and get you all hyped up and excited about the, you know, being able to retire in 6 months and all that good stuff?
Yeah, sell you the dream.
Okay. So coming away from that, I mean, obviously both switched on, smart, ambitious people. Stepping away from that weekend, what were your thoughts in terms of what your property goals looked like and the type of strategy that you would go after, first of all?
Well, we always kind of viewed it as a vehicle to, replacing at least one of our incomes. And it primarily was focused at, you know, wanting to start a family and, you know, doing that real juggle of, you know, working full time, having a newborn baby, the financial stress and struggles of dealing with all of that, and how we didn't really want to go through that battle, and property could be the vehicle to give us, you know, a much better start to our family life. And so buy to lets was our main focus because we wanted the cash flow. We entertained a couple of other different sort of strategies at the start, but, you know, we kind of focused in on buy-to-lets very quickly.
And what the course showed us is we didn't need to buy in Kent because we couldn't afford to buy in Kent. We could look a bit further afield, and it opened our eyes to the north and what you can get for your money in the north. So that's what we did. We travelled, didn't we?
Got you. So you're one of those southerners that's coming up here, stealing our houses, stealing our deals. Makes sense.
Exactly.
Okay. But interestingly, yeah, that you're just talking about, you know, sort of fairly basic, I presume, single lets here. Nothing, you know, in the early days, it wasn't a case of, you know, HMOs or serviced accommodation or development. You kind of figured that just single lets alone would be enough to get you to your goals.
Yeah, so when we did the courses, the sort of bottom line on the buy to lets were kind of like £100-£150 a month cash flow, and you know, not really a lot to excite many people. But we found once we finally kind of settled on the area that we wanted to invest in, that actually, you know, like our worst performing asset is probably like £300 or more a month like profit.
Yeah.
And then from like really kind of low value properties in comparison to what we kind of used to seeing. So we found that actually buy-to-lets was a really good, it was kind of stable, you know, everyone talks about it being the foundation of their property portfolio, and it's quite passive. So it ticked a lot of boxes for us, really.
And can you tell me what one of those sort of early deals looked like that was generating you £300 a month in terms of, you know, how much were you spending on it? Did you have to do a lot of renovation? Were you refinancing them at the end, or was it a fairly simple, just buy something on the open market and get tenants in there?
So our first property deal after doing the training is probably our worst deal, as is everyone's, but, you know, we learned an enormous amount doing it. So we bought it for 75. We ended up absolutely gutting it back to brick, top to bottom, new windows, new electrics, installing gas central heating for the first time. There was a garage that needed a new roof. It was kind of everything, really. Mm-hmm. We spent $25,000 on that, and then it only revalued at $110,000. So, yeah, we were kind of like all in cost wise at about $100,000, revalued at $110,000. So we left quite a bit of money in, more than we would have liked. Mm-hmm. But as I said, we kind of learned so much from doing it that it made the next few deals, you know, much, much better. That one in particular, cash flow is about £450 a month.
Wow. Yeah, so even though we left a decent amount in it, it's a very good performing buy to let.
Yeah, I mean, from a return on cash point of view, 450, so you're up at what, like 20-25% return, something like that?
Yeah, so we bought the property on the basis that we would be getting sort of like 35-40% return on cash. Mm-hmm. And it ended up about 25%, so, you know, we're not going to cry about it too much.
I mean, that's but still phenomenal. Mind,
well, yeah, when you put it like that, but for us at the time, because we didn't have an awful lot of money to leave in the deal, we just got married, so all our money was tied up with wedding stuff. So, yes, it felt a bit painful at the time.
Yeah, but yeah, yes, I get that. You want it to work hard for you, but I mean, yeah, still on paper, to most people, I'd say that is still a very good deal. If we could get a 25% return on cash, you know, I'd be doing deals like that every day. And I suppose that's you know, that's part of it. You said yourself, Alan, that it feels your first deal's your worst one. It feels like that, but the education you get from doing something like that, right, in terms of understanding the sourcing process, understanding how to renovate properties, everything you learned from that will have gone on to make every subsequent deal better, and you still get a decent return from all of that education as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, one of the sort of harsh lessons we learned was that you know, we kind of had an appreciation for what was considered a mortgageable property. And we tried to get a mortgage on the house when we bought it, but it didn't have a gas central heating system. So the kind of valuer walked in, turned around, walked back out, and zero valuation. So a bit naive on our part, but what that was kind of at the 11th hour. So what we ended up doing was raising angel finance within like a couple of days to just buy the property cash, and we would never have kind of done that unless we were forced into that position. And, you know, that kind of, that was such a big barrier for when we first started. We couldn't believe that other people would want to invest their money in property purchases that we were doing. That deal forced our hand to do that, and now we've, you know, we use angel finance for all of our property purchases in some way or another. And you know, that's an element of our property investing journey that we've actually, you know, found quite easy now.
Yeah, absolutely. Finding the deals is much harder than finding the finance, we find.
yeah, I'd generally subscribe to that. It's funny, you know, some people will become very good at one and struggle with the other. It's all about balance, right? Trying to get them both going at the same time. But if you know that you've got a good pool of cash behind you, I guess it kind of free, it's one less thing to worry about. You can now focus your time on finding those good deals so that you can keep your investors happy, and as long as you can do them, the kind of sky's the limit, I guess, with how far you can grow this thing.
Exactly.
And something we can talk about towards the end of the journey, the HMO that we're doing at the moment, another good example of forcing ourselves into a situation. When we had our bridging application for that property kind of on the table, about to kind of accept it, we worked out how much interest we were going to be paying, and it was just ludicrous amount. And through a bit of throwing my toys out of the pram, I just kind of said, right, cancel the application. We're going to fund it through angel finance, and we're going to get the money off Instagram, and it's all going to be fine. And Rosie was a big doubter, but we managed to get 160K in 24 hours off Instagram, so it turned out all right in the end.
I love that. And I'm glad you said it, because it's something that I am always shouting about, is the, you know, private finance, the savings that you can make, even if you're giving your investors a similar rate of return to the interest that you'd be paying on bridging. When you count all the the fees, the arrangement fees, the legal fees, valuations. If it's development finance, you've got fees every time there's a drawdown. I mean, they can, in some cases, double the cost of the finance, and you think you're paying 10, 11%. It's actually up closer to, like, it's astronomical. And if you can find investors, you're solving a problem for them. You're significantly reducing your own costs as well. I mean, the win-win that you're creating is, like, it's just amazing.
Absolutely. And also the hoops they make you jump through, bridging companies. And that was partly why Alan was throwing his toys at the pram, because it was just one thing after the next, another fee, and then, oh, we need this, your inside leg measurement before we can go on to the next bit. It was getting ridiculous. And that was our first bridging application that we'd gone through. And we felt very bad because we pulled it at the last minute. But we, being able to get the angel finance was great.
I mean, it was exactly as you say, Mike. You know, you, on the face of it, you see the sort of 0.9% per month. You know, you're going to expose to about 10% interest for the project, and that doesn't seem too bad. But, you know, you've got to pay a surveyor £400 to come out every time you want to do a drawdown. It's a £1,500 valuation fee. It's 2% in, 1% out. All of these kind of, it just stacks up and ended up doubling the cost of the finance.
Yeah, yeah. And it's the hoops as well. It's a simple example. It's nowhere near the worst hoop I've been asked to jump through, but it's on my mind because it was sent to me this morning from our broker saying, oh, the lenders have come back and asked about a discrepancy between your tax return and your tax year overview or something like that. And I was like, oh God, you know, what's going on? What if our accountants got wrong here? Blah, blah, blah. Went to the accountants and they're like, well, what is the discrepancy? They were pushing back on this application because there was something like a 17 pence discrepancy between our tax return and the tax year overview. And apparently it's just HMRC rounding something up. And it's bonkers. They must see this on a daily basis. And to use that as a reason to delay things probably by another week, you know, it wears on you. And, you know, it's nice, Alan, that, you know, you almost had this, you were pushed, this frustration forced you to find a better way.
Yeah.
It forces me to post. He forces me to find the money.
Yeah, well, it forces Alan to then have the conversation with you who, okay, fine. It's maybe not quite as linear as I had in my head, but we all reach the same conclusion anyway. Something else that's interesting about that, and this is where our opinions on things differ slightly. I'm a big advocate of investing close to home if possible, and it's always nice to hear stories from people who have been able to make it work by going slightly further afield. And I know it's easy for me to say that sitting in Stockport where house prices are considerably cheaper than down south. Was it predominantly cost that forced you to look further afield?
Yeah, I mean, as a comparable, we've got a buy-to-let, which is our old home in Kent. Well, the Gravesend house that Alan was talking about earlier. We bought that for £250,000. We rent out for £1,000 a month. A comparable house in our investment area on the Wirral, we bought for 76,000, did a bit of work to it, granted, but we rent that out for 695. So you can really see a difference there, and it was just a no-brainer for us.
Yeah, yeah, with numbers like that, it's difficult to ignore. How have you found the additional time, I guess, the additional effort required to manage a project remotely? I guess that has challenges versus doing something on your doorstep where you could be on site every day if need be.
Yeah, it's certainly not easy and not for the faint-hearted, but we've made it work. The first project we did that Alan spoke about earlier, that was tough because it was brand new build team, and actually they weren't a very good build team and ended up taking a lot longer than they should have done, and needed a lot of managing. And because we weren't there, they were able to take the mick a bit, which they did. So fast forward to the next project, we'd got a new build team who are very good. And that's really key to it, having a team you can trust who will get on with it and will keep in contact with you throughout and send videos. And understand that you can't be there all the time. So currently our HMO project that we're doing, the 12-bed HMO. I'm going up every 2 weeks at the moment, and every other week we have a video and a call, and then call whenever needed about little bits and bobs.
Okay, so roughly every 2 weeks you're physically on site, and then every other week they're sending you some content, some way of seeing progress.
Exactly.
Okay.
And that project in particular, we knew it was going to be our biggest renovation. So we put, and it was a quite a long drawn out planning application. So we had a lot of time to prepare, and we did do a significant amount of preparation. You know, defining the builder like laughed his head off when Rosie sent over the specification, because it was like 17 pages long, and he was just chuckling at it was the most detailed thing he'd ever seen. And we post quite a bit on Instagram about the electrical plans for the building Rosie put together, and it's got about 95 different colour symbols on each room, prescribing exactly the measurements. That is going to, how high plug sockets are going to be, where everything is going to be in the whole house. So we did quite a comprehensive preparation for that project, knowing that you know, we were going to be doing it from afar, and it was going to be our biggest one.
Yeah, I know. I know why you're kind of laughing and joking at yourselves for that, but you know, the reality is that stuff helps. It avoids confusion on site. If there are any issues, you can point them back to that specification and say, no, this is what we, rather than just having a phone call or, you know, some text messages back and forwards. If everything's down in black and white, it's much more difficult to argue with when they do something wrong, if they go off schedule. So yeah, you know, it's a bit of effort. You maybe feel like you went overkill, but if something, I suppose it's all about protection, it's insurance, isn't it? You hope nothing goes wrong, but if it does, you know, you've done everything you can to give them the information they need, and then you know who you can hold accountable when things do start to diverge. And the beauty is as well, these documents, a lot of what you've done is reapplicable now. You know, you'll have a spec for an HMO bedroom that can apply to pretty much every HMO bedroom you do going forward. So each one will be a little bit easier, a little bit quicker, and your build team will hopefully get more familiar with what you expect and the standards that you're striving for as well.
Exactly. We'll certainly use this even on other buy-to-let projects where we've done quite a lot of them now. The builders know what we like, what we want. So although we still have a spec and we go through it, it's never this detailed. But actually, it's important to have that detail. And I think we'll use it for even just the vanilla buy-to-let going forward.
Yeah, for sure. Was there a point in time in your journey, I always sort of have to gag a little bit when I use that word, but it kind of sums up what we're talking about. So from deciding you're going to invest in property, was there a sort of turning point? Was there a moment when you looked at each other and thought, yeah, there's something more to this. This could be a career for us. This could be a full-time gig rather than just a bit of a sideline.
Yeah. So, the property seminar we were talking about earlier, that was kind of like a 2-hour evening, and then, you know, that lured us into the 3-day weekend. I think it was on a train journey on the way home on the second day. It's funny because the first day we were sitting there like crossed arms, like, oh, here we go, the hard sell. You know, we're not this stupid. We're not going to sign up to this. And then the second day on the way home, we were like, oh my God, this could change our lives. Let's sign up as soon as we get there tomorrow.
Yeah.
And we're so not impulsive people like that. I mean, I'm sure Alan will say at some point during this interview, because he likes to tell everyone, I do not spend money. It takes a lot for me to part with money.
Okay.
So it was not like us at all, but we did just turn to each other and say, yeah, let's do it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I know there's a lot of maybe hesitation, there's a lot of negativity out there about education, about the industry generally, about specific companies, but with, I don't know, 300 and something, you might know better than me, Rosie, however many episodes we have done, there are a significant number of people who have gone through some form of education and come on here and say it was the best decision that they made. And you can't argue with that. It's not for everyone. And I think there are some unscrupulous people out there who are either overcharging or under-delivering, or maybe a combination of both. But like I say, the numbers don't lie. And you guys are smart. You had good jobs. You were ambitious. You maybe could have gone on to achieve this on your own without education, but you did it. It helped you get from where you were to where you wanted to be. I don't think there's much wrong with that, you know?
Absolutely. And I think part of it was the fact that we put that money into that training. I'm sure you've heard horror stories of how much this training can be. I think it meant we had to do it. It wasn't an option. We had to make it work because we'd spent that much money on our education.
Yeah, no, that's a good point. You know, if you kind of put your money where your mouth is, you don't want to turn around to the family at Christmas and say, oh God, we dropped 10, 15, 20 grand on this. And yeah, we kind of got fed up after a couple of weeks. It almost forces you to hold yourself accountable, I guess.
Absolutely.
And yeah, again, in the beginning, when we first started, we went up to the Wirral every 3 weeks without fail. And we did like 15 viewings every time we went there. And it took, you know, we put 10 offers in every time we went up. And it took 9 months before we got our first offer accepted.
Yeah.
And throughout that entire time, it was just so demoralising, you know, continuously failing for such a long period. But you know, as well as each other, one of the things that does keep you going and keep you motivated is I've spent so much money on this education and made such a big life-changing decision. I cannot give up this quickly.
Yeah.
And also one thing we've done from the start is tell everyone what we're doing. Mm-hmm. which is I put our success with raising finance down to that. We tell everyone. So it was we told everyone what we were doing. We couldn't not do it.
Yeah. No, I get that. And I thank you for sharing the fact that, you know, you went through those 9 painful months before the first deal came. That's sometimes the reality of it, but if you know what you're looking for and you persevere, I think it's about consistency, about perseverance, and about having that knowledge. You know, any one of those things maybe isn't enough on its own, but if you know what you're looking for and you are consistent with your actions, then eventually it will come to be. And yeah, it took you guys 9 months. Some people will do it in 3, some will do it in 6, some will take 18. But if you know, if you're committed to it, and it sounds like you guys were, well, obviously you were, it did happen eventually. And then I don't know if you'd agree, but once you've got that first one under your belt, the next one always feels a little bit easier, and the next one a little bit easier again, and you start to get this momentum and this sort of snowball effect.
That's it. Well, the second one ended up being 3 flats in one, so very quickly it snowballed, because 3-for-1 was pretty good for us.
Yeah,
absolutely. So did your strategy start to change? Was it fairly fluid from day one then, in terms of what you were looking for and the type of projects you were willing to take on?
So I think we always wanted to operate on the same model, in that we buy rundown, we do a fairly comprehensive refurb, and then we would refinance and recycle the money and go again somewhere else. We did not write off, but we weren't particularly keen on flats in the beginning, because of, you know, the additional costs you can incur with like ground rent and service charges and things like that can kill your cash flow. But we managed to negotiate direct to vendor for the flat purchase. Only one of them was on the market, and we found out that he did own the whole building and he would be interested in selling the whole thing. But because he'd had it for so long, he had a huge capital gains exposure. He wanted to sell one per tax year.
Okay.
So we managed to negotiate the price for all 3, and we are just about in the process right now of refinancing the third one after buying and renovating them all. So that's kind of ticked along really nicely, one per tax year for us. And he's got quite a large portfolio that he's planning to offload. So hopefully we'll get a few more per year now that he's got the biggest capital gains burdens out of the way.
Nice. I love that story. The HMO is obviously something that I'm keen to talk about, something that you've been talking about a lot on social media. So we can direct people there if they want to, see more of this project rather than just hear about it. But was that something that you thought you would get to eventually, or were you intentionally staying away from HMOs? What were your views on that as a strategy?
We were staying well away. We weren't interested at all. The numbers in our area for sort of 5 to 6 bedroom HMOs were not too dissimilar to our very good cash flowing buy to let at £450 profit. So the incentive wasn't really there for us to go for four, five, six bedroom HMOs for the extra hassle.
We were talking about, instead of £400 a month cash flow, the numbers we were working out, we're talking about like £600-700 a month. And as Rosie said, it felt like significantly more hassle and more risk for not much more reward. So we kind of shied away from it. But, you know, Rosie's got a great story for how this one came around.
So we did a leaflet campaign, and it wasn't really a leaflet. It was a handwritten letter by me, photocopied 3,000 times, saying, we'd like to buy your house if you're interested in selling.
Hold on, 3,000 times?
3,000 times.
Wow, so, okay, volume, I like it.
Yeah. So, I mean, that was only because the leaflet company we were using had a minimum order quantity of 3,000. So I thought, oh, let's give it a go, see what we get.
It was the first time we'd ever done like a direct to vendor sort of mass distribution of leaflets or letters. So, yeah, 12 bedroom HMO from the first direct to vendor campaign is not too bad return.
Not too bad. And to be fair, the area that was leafleted is lots of big buildings. We were looking for little buy to lets. So either the leafleter went out of the area that I gave them, or I don't know, but the stars aligned and this person phoned me with a block of four flats for sale that wasn't on the market. And was I interested? So we went and had a look, didn't we? And it turned out that the guy selling actually looked us up to see if we were genuine and found that we had a mutual friend, which was a friend of Alan's from university. So he spoke to him to see whether we were genuine. So it all worked in our favour.
Wow. Yeah, I love that. And, it's these connections. You can't plan for them. But again, if you're consistent, you send out 3,000 letters, one of them is going to be connected to you somehow, right?
Exactly.
And that's a good thing about building the social media brands. You know, if we didn't really put a lot of effort in, I'll say Rose puts a lot of effort in. And if we didn't spend so much time, building the brand and, putting the content out there, he may have looked us up and, didn't really think much of us or, didn't think we were particularly credible. And we wouldn't have been able to get the deal. So, we always tell people that Instagram is a great place for, the property community, like you said at the start, and we've had such good experience, from a qualitative point of view and sharing stories and stuff. And this deal is one of the good news stories to come of it as well.
Yeah, I love that. Did you say that it was four flats? And if so, what was it that, that sounds like it kind of fits. It's right up your street. You had four single lets to the portfolio, but what was it that made you think, no, let's convert this into an HMO?
So when we say four flats, it was illegally converted in the 70s with no fire separation, no fire safety anywhere. You actually walk through the ground floor flat to get to any of the other flats.
Oh,
so
wow.
It wasn't fit for purpose. So straight away, we couldn't figure out a way of making four flats work, six flats work, anything work as flats. So our only option was an HMO. So that's when we decided to go through planning, which was our first time through planning and possibly our last time through planning.
Wait, it wasn't a great experience then?
No, it wasn't.
I mentioned throwing toys out of pram earlier. Yeah, it happened on a daily basis.
Yes, so we got there in the end, but not really because of planning. We're using our permitted development rights. We're doing 2 6-bed HMOs on top of each other instead of a 12-bed HMO.
Okay, which I like. You know, it will appeal to some people who maybe want to stay in a smaller place. I think there are definite splits. Some people prefer the smaller, more intimate. Some people equally. We've got people who love our bigger houses because they've got more communal space and, you know, definitely different vibes between the houses. But that idea of, you know, splitting it multiple HMOs within the same unit can work really well as well.
Yeah,
that was the key kind of trade-off for us. You know, we thought it was a real sort of plan C approach. You know, we were a bit downbeaten about when we came up and got the, you know, we were going to have to go with the 2 6-beds because we fought really hard for the 12-bed. And there is absolutely the pros and cons of both. The communal area was the key thing we were fighting for because, you know, it's 4 floors. It's sort of 85 meters squared per floor, so it's a very big building. Mm-hmm. And we were going to use the entire bottom floor as communal space, so, you know, we had grand plans for like a games room, a cinema, and enormous open plan kitchens, all this kind of stuff. But having to split it into 2 6-bed HMOs, you know, we're having to separate out that communal space, different kitchens in different parts of the houses, and it breaks up that kind of community feel a little bit. But there are lots of pros to it as well, especially now with COVID. You know, some people might be put off sharing a house with 12 people. So yeah, it's kind of turned out quite well, even if we thought it wasn't the best approach to start with.
But we don't like thinking about that because we went through hell and back with planning and we needn't have.
It's all part of the learning experience, right? And, you know, it'll come valuable on some other project in the future. It'll all start to pay for itself again.
Yeah, exactly.
I love a number. And I know we shared a bit of info before we started recording this. And you, like me, you know, whenever we do a case study, I am equally reluctant to share end values when they are projected. I'd rather wait until the refinance is through, but I'm a little bit impatient and I probably won't get the chance to speak to you again for at least a year or two, hopefully by which point this is well done and dusted and old news. So if you don't mind, can I ask you to sort of break your rule and share some of the numbers with the sort of projected end values, and then we can maybe do a little recap once the project is finished and you can let us know how it's actually ended up.
Yeah, sure. So this is an IPI exclusive.
You heard it here first.
So we are purchasing the property for $172K. Mm-hmm. We're anticipating doing about $170K refurb. And then all other fees, including finance and stamp duty and stuff like that, about $30K. So we're all in about 340, 350, and we anticipate the GDV is going to be somewhere between sort of 470, 500.
So you're pretty close to getting all your money out, depending on what end of that 470 to 500 it ends up. Is there a chance you'll get everything back out of that?
So I think we worked out we need something like 502K GDV to be money in, money out.
Okay.
We had a commercial valuation done about a year ago when we first started the process, and that was at 450, and that used quite a considerable number of sort of conservative factors. You know, very, very low average sort of rental, very aggressive operating cost percentages, and then a few sort of other valuers and brokers that we've spoken to afterwards, all have shared a very similar opinion that it's a very conservative valuation. So, I mean, Rosie's kind of confidently agreeing with me that we should be getting 470. I've laid my line in the sand and I said I reckon we'll get 525. So
wow.
We'll have to see how it goes.
Love it. I love it.
And I'm always pessimistic. So
we've got the optimistic valuation on and every project that we've done to date, except for the first one. We've always had this range that we've said we think we're going to get at the end. And I've always pushed the upper limit of what could be reasonably expected. And we've landed on our feet and got it almost every time. So touch wood.
We would still be very happy with 450 because the return is so good. 12 bedrooms, £110 a week is pretty good going on cash flow. So yeah, 450 would still be okay for us. So we're very happy.
Yeah, for sure. And it's, you know, just looking at the numbers for that project, it's an interesting one. It's the type of situation we find ourselves in fairly often where we're spending as much, if not more, on the renovations than the actual purchase of the building. And that really intimidates people. But you've got the scope then to add so much value because you're really transforming it. You're not just, you know, converting a lounge into a bedroom. You are creating something unique. You are significantly enhancing and improving the building, and you can get these really strong end values and have these really high cash flowing assets as a result of that investment, which feels a little scary at the time. But yeah, it can definitely be a strategy that pays off massively in the long run.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and I think, you know, in some circumstances, some HMOs, when you're getting commercial valuations, you can potentially stray quite far away from the bricks and mortar valuation of the property.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, we're fairly confident that the bricks and mortar value of the property is in excess of 400K. So, you know, we might be pushing the upper limit on the GDV from a commercial point of view, but, you know, we're not getting into risky territory of overexposing ourselves. So, you know, it's a very good deal from quite a few angles. So, you know, we're happy that we're jumping in the HMO pool.
Yeah, I think that's a reasonable metric. You know, you might be getting it valued on a commercial basis for more than its bricks and mortar value, but you're probably not going to be borrowing more than its bricks and mortar value. So you've still got you know, a fairly decent exit there should your plans change, should the market change. You know, you'll be able to shift this and clear your debt and not be in a difficult predicament.
Exactly.
So you had some good news in, well, I guess it's probably been on the radar for a while, but January this year, Rosie, I guess a big change in lifestyle for you.
Yes, so I left my day job, which felt like a long time coming. I'd been working for a local charity for 4 years, and in that time I'd condensed my hours, so I was getting one property day a week. And then as of January, I left completely, which was very nice.
Fantastic. Congratulations, first of all. I mean, it's a big step, obviously. It's something that a lot of us are striving from property, but to be there, yeah, a phenomenal success, and just worth recognizing that for a second, and saying congratulations to you. Does it feel, I mean, was it a big moment? Was it everything you ever hoped for?
I'm still getting used to it. It's a funny one. I don't know how I was working full time, that's for sure, because I feel very busy all of a sudden. But yes, it's been brilliant. Really, really enjoying it.
What was it that did you have a specific goal in mind? Did you know when you would make that jump? Was it a time-based deadline? Was it an income-based deadline? Did you sit down and have this conversation and say, when we get to X, we can take this next step?
Well, Alan kept moving the goalposts.
Okay.
Yeah, the goalposts were always fixed, and the planning department kept moving them.
Okay.
Yeah, so the idea was always to replace my salary, which we did, and then it was, because we had this HMO, we needed to complete on it. And because we'd exchanged subject planning kept going and going and going, and we weren't completing. So I was still in the day job for quite some time after setting that goal and thinking we were going to complete within a few months. We had the offer accepted on this HMO in May 2019, so it's been a long old slog.
Yeah, yeah, they have a habit of doing that, don't they, these bigger projects? They can just seem to drag on. And I think, you know, that's an interesting point as well in terms of trying to balance everything. There is something, going back to your original strategy of single lets, there's something to be said about the simplicity of them. You know, you can still get good returns on cash. You can get through them quickly. You've got a fairly good idea of the refinance because it's kind of bricks and mortar. If you know what the neighbor is worth, you know, you've got a rough idea what yours is worth. There is, you know, I think that's the sometimes I get in the habit of thinking, you know, we need to keep doing bigger and bigger. But actually, the longer we spend in the industry, sometimes you get drawn back to these simple projects because, you know, you can get through them quickly. You don't need to worry about planning officers or, you know, the local neighbors kicking up a stink about it. So it swings and roundabouts. They've both got massive appeal. But yeah, you're spot on. These they can take a while, and they'll certainly give you a couple of sleepless nights.
That's it. And if you're working full time, I mean, this was the only project we had. Well, we had a couple of bits going on, but it was the main project we had going on for quite some time, because we both working full-time jobs, we just didn't have the time. And if this one hadn't have come off, we would have wasted all that time. So actually, just plodding along with buy-to-lets can sometimes be the best option.
Yeah, absolutely. What does the next goal look like? Have you thought about where you want to take the business in the future? And, you know, again, from a, whether it's a strategy point of view, is it a step up in income level? I don't want to ask the question, Alan. You never know who's listening to this, so I'm not going to put you on the spot and say what your longer term goals are unless you're happy to share. But just generally, from a business point of view, what happens next for you?
Well, if my boss is listening, I'm definitely going to be working there for the foreseeable future. Don't worry. So I think our goals have primarily been set around income levels. So, you know, we set ourselves a fairly ambitious target this year of tripling our monthly profit that we made from the property portfolio. So Rosie talked about, you know, we managed to achieve an income level that was equal to her salary before she handed in her notice. The HMO project will kind of double that income. Mm-hmm. From the property portfolio, so we'll be kind of 2x, and then we want to go, you know, go again and go 3x our existing income levels by the end of this year. And we've got a couple of different kind of routes that we're going to explore. You talked about earlier investing closer to home. Now we've got a really kind of strong platform and a foundation of properties up in the northwest, and we've learned so much through all the mistakes and the successes, and we're going to be looking a bit closer to home at you know, blocks of freehold flats in Kent, and how we can add value through buying multiple units under one freehold. It also gives us the opportunity to not have to do such comprehensive renovation projects to add value. So that's something that we're really keen to explore more and add to the portfolio in that way over the next couple of years. But yeah, a slightly longer term sort of 5-year plan is going to be in the forever home. Mm-hmm. And you know, we haven't kind of spoken about yet the house we live in now in Canterbury. It was probably, you know, one of our best projects. You know, we bought it run down, we've done it up, and you know, I managed to achieve quite a lot of equity gain. But you know, we want to try and do something similar but on a bigger scale for our forever home. So
possibly some sort of self-build. We've watched Rua Property and all sorts of people do some wonderful things, so yeah, self-builds possibly on the horizon.
Yeah, you're talking about Charlene's project there.
Yes, yeah. That's it.
Phenomenal, isn't it? And yeah, I mean, I just in the interest of time, I won't dig into the details of that, your own home, in too much detail. But it's something, again, I'm such an advocate of. You know, your own home has got such a potential to boost your wealth, to become a very tax efficient investment for you. And I think because you inject a little bit more of your personality into it, you know, people think when they're flipping houses, keep everything neutral and try to appeal to as many people as possible. But, you know, as you've found, our own home has always been the one that we've added the most value to. And I think it's because we're, you know, we add a bit more personality to it. Maybe it doesn't appeal to everyone, but it appeals more to some people, and you only need one buyer. So as long as it's not crazy, that slightly more, you know, design led, the choices that you make for your own home, I think can actually enhance that, that end product than just trying to keep everything neutral, whether it's beige or gray or, you know, whatever the current trend is for neutrals in a flip project. So yeah, again, you know, it's something that I'm a big advocate of, and nice to hear you guys have had similar experiences with it.
Agreed. And if we were to do one thing differently, I think it would be, if we were to turn back time, it would be buying a doer-upper as our first home, mm-hmm. because you really can do a lot with your home.
Yeah, now we've seen and experienced the amount of you know, wealth we've managed to generate out of this project, and compare that to the amount of sort of organic capital appreciation that's happened on our Gravesend house in comparison. You know, it's very small in comparison to what we've been able to achieve on this house. So, yeah, it's definitely opened our eyes to our home being a key investment.
Yeah, glad to hear it. And I like the idea of the forever home. I'll be interested to see if 5 years after being in it, you don't get itchy feet again and think, well, this was kind of like the middle ground forever home, and then, you know, this is the forever. I think there's different stages of forever homes, but yeah, it's a nice idea. I am conscious we've been talking for almost an hour now. There's a couple more questions that I want to squeeze in. So I haven't done like a quick fire round for a long time, but I'm basically going to use the term quickfire round to say we need to get through these questions with relatively short answers, because I still want to know what your thoughts are on them, if that's all right.
No problem.
Cool, love it. So first thing I want to ask, just very briefly, your business, what does that look like? It's a question that we're getting asked more and more in terms of, you know, what does it take? What support do you need? What does your team look like in order to grow a portfolio? Is it just the two of you? Do you have employees, virtual assistants? Obviously, you've got a team on the ground locally. So can you talk through your business structure?
So funny you should talk about virtual assistants, because this Friday I am interviewing for a VA. That will be the first member of our team besides just the two of us. Mm-hmm.
Don't forget Freddie.
And Freddie, of course.
The puppy.
Yes. Yeah, your mascot. Chief marketing officer, something like that. And I say quickly, I obviously ask a question and then I get like six more, so forgive me. But you two, you know, it is a different dynamic to doing it yourself. I think it's always great to have support of a partner, whether it's just a business partner, a life partner. How do you two split the roles and responsibilities?
Generally, Rosie does everything, and then I just throw tantrums. That's how it works.
He's not wrong.
I love it. It's fine. Yeah, no, great. What is the... great. You're going to give me a genuine answer, Alan.
Sorry. In my current job, I do quite a lot of like strategy and new business and stuff like that. So I kind of focus on slightly more forward-thinking, bigger picture. This is where I want to take the business in the next couple of years, and these are the sorts of things we need to do to get there. And then I just put my feet up and drink tea, and Rosie makes it all happen.
It's you know, it's something I've been digging into more recently, particularly there's a book called Rocket Fuel, which is about the relationship between those two roles. You've got like the visionary, which kind of sounds like you, Alan, and then Rosie, you're, I guess, like operations director. You know, you're running the business effectively, and it's that relationship and that combination of skills is proven to be a very successful combination when it comes to running and scaling businesses. So it's interesting that you've ended up in that same place that I'm doing a lot of digging into and researching just now. But yeah, no, sounds like a winning combination. What is the biggest struggle that you have faced in the growth of your property portfolio?
I think our first project dealing with builders, I mean, dealing with builders full stop, as I'm sure anyone in property will say, is one of the hardest things.
Rosie's just about learned to speak Scouse now.
Especially as a young female, I think it's very easy to be intimidated, as much as I don't want to be intimidated, when builders are talking at you as if you know what they're talking about. That can be difficult. So I'm slowly getting used to it and giving them a run for their money at the minute, aren't I?
Yeah, yeah.
Keeping them on their toes. So
got your pink clipboard and everything.
Yeah.
I love it. What would you say has been the most important change to yourselves, to your mindset, to how you operate that has enabled you to achieve all of this success that you've created?
I think from a really hand-wavy point of view, I think there's some of the circumstances we pushed ourselves into, like the angel finance ones we talked about earlier. It kind of just kind of proves to us over and over again that we literally don't have any limits to what we can achieve if we just push ourselves to do it. And sometimes, you know, you kind of back yourself into the comfort zone and tell yourself things are going to be really hard and you can't do X, Y, and Z. But actually, every time we've like thrown ourselves off the cliff, we've managed to swim at the bottom. So that's been a quite big mindset change, just continually pushing ourselves past what we think is possible and still being able to make it happen.
Yeah, that's really powerful. And finally, we kind of touched on this at the start, Alan, but advice to somebody who is just starting out, what would you, I mean, the market's going to be a little bit different now to when you guys started out 3 or 4 years ago, but what advice would you give to somebody who was just looking to get started?
Oh, you mean different advice to listening to your podcast, you mean?
Well, we can remind people to do that. Yeah, I like you getting that back in there. But aside from the podcast, anything else?
So as we've touched on, using your own home as an investment vehicle is incredible. And also documenting your journey. You mm-hmm. never know who's watching and you never know who's your next potential investor. And that's been really powerful for us, Instagram. We wish we'd started a bit earlier, but it's been a brilliant tool for us.
And we always kind of say that actually, when you boil it down, property investing is actually not complicated. It's just so much hard work. So don't be disillusioned by how much hard work it's going to take. But everyone can achieve it because it's not, you know, it's not rocket science.
Yeah, I love that, and I completely agree with it. So that brings us to the end. The only thing that I have left to ask you is just in terms of contact details, the best place to get in touch with you, to find out more about you, to follow the progress on the 12-bedroom HMO and everything else that you've got going on. We've mentioned Instagram a couple of times, so I guess that's a good place to start.
Yeah, Instagram's our big one. So it's at Arch Investments. And then we're also on Facebook with the same name, Arch Investments. And then our website, for anyone who's interested in having a look at what we're up to, is www.arch-investments.co.uk.
And I mean, there you will get obviously property updates. You'll get some of the cutest puppy pictures going on the internet right now. How is life as new puppy parents?
I think we have just about completed the catalogue of Freddy photos, so that's going to be available to purchase as calendars and mugs and things as next year.
You could do a picture of Freddy in each of the 12 HMO bedrooms, and then you've got your calendar sorted.
Exactly. Yeah. No, it's been a bit tricky, as you all appreciate. I think we felt like it was going to be hard work. It was even harder. Still getting up in the middle of the night, but he's very, very well behaved, and we wouldn't have him any other way.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, it's a winning combo of property and puppies. Works well for me, and I'm sure other people will be interested in checking you out as well. So I just want to say a massive thanks to you guys for being here today. It's been a blast having you on. You've shared a ton of insights and a ton of value. I hope you've enjoyed it, and I hope we get the chance to speak again soon.
Thank you so much, Mike. We've really enjoyed it.
Yeah, brilliant. Thank you very much.